I used to be so sure of myself. I was a crispy chicken person. Chicken McNuggets made with all white meat chicken had me from the first bite. But ever since trying McDonald's garlic white cheddar grilled chicken sandwich, I can't stop thinking about the perfectly marinated grilled chicken. Have I become a grilled chicken person?
Enjoy chicken at McDonald's. Whether it's crispy like the buttermilk crispy tenders, grilled in your favorite chicken sandwich, dipped in sauce or not, McDonald's, chicken how you like it. At participating McDonald's.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. Now, I was at home, inside my house, in my office, with all the windows closed, when my thoughts were suddenly drowned out by some chickie's loud argument. I open my front door, and I look out. There's this woman parked in a blue Volkswagen Bug on the other side of the street. She's on her cell phone, on her speakerphone, yelling into it and out her open driver's side window. She's broadcasting her conversation to every house on my block. So I'm annoyed. I'm really annoyed because I was working and I was in a good jag. And so I go out on my porch, and in my annoyance, I called to her, "I can hear you inside my house." Now, my annoyance came from a reasonable presumption, which is that the sounds you hear in your house will be house sounds, you know, the tea kettle whistling, the bacon frying, your dog snoring. And that is reasonable, but usually I know better than to just go out and snarl at somebody. Believe me, the first thing I want to do is do that, or better yet, scream obscenities at them. But as my guest tonight points out in his book, criticizing somebody's behavior is not a way to get them to change. In this case, it was a way to get the girl to come stand in front of my gate and scream obscenities at me. I'm hoping tonight's show will make me a little more mindful to behave a little smarter in the future. So tonight's guest is psychotherapist Carl Lasko, PhD. He's back for a second appearance on my radio show to talk about blame, which is one of the most toxic and destructive components of relationships and many human interactions. Tonight, Dr. Lasko will be telling us how we can stop blaming and how to take healthier and far more productive steps to problem solving in relationships and beyond. Dr. Lasko has written a very comprehensive book on blame. It's called Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit. Hello, Carl.
I'm here. Good evening.
Good evening. So tell us, what is blame?
Well, there's the everyday idea about blame, which is that it's a way to get people to change. If I don't blame you for doing something wrong, then you won't change your behavior. And when something happens, we have to assign blame. We think we do. And as a way to get people to know that they did something wrong, right?
Right.
Now, that's the operating definition that's been guiding our society.
So the operating definition, that's the one of assigning responsibility for some fault or wrongdoing is blaming.
And telling the person that with an emotional content that the mistake is in some ways serious enough that you're really upset and you are dumping your upset onto the other person, which is essentially giving the message that there's something wrong. So one of my most common domestic examples is, for instance, forgetting to make a phone call, and you say to your partner, "Well, why didn't you make that call?" And implied in that tone of voice is, "Why are you so stupid you didn't make the call? What is wrong with you that you didn't make the call?" That's a blaming statement, and that's what doesn't work.
I love that. You talk about these why statements in your book, that there are all these covert ways that people blame. I just wanted to read, there was a great quote, you know, almost midway through your book, that really sort of tells us about why we have to get rid of this. And you explain all these things in your book, but you say blame is primitive and inefficient. It's the communicational equivalent of parchment and goose quills. And
yeah.
You say no longer has any legitimate role in our intensely interconnected world, you know, with the iPhone and the BlackBerry. And from the most basic viewpoint of efficiency, our society needs a far more effective method of dealing with relationship problems and conflict.
Yes.
And when you talk about blame, you say it isn't just a single behavior. It's a three-part syndrome with a blame attack, the emotional impact, and the reactive response.
Exactly. So if I say to my wife, for instance, I say, well, why didn't you make that phone call? Well, let me reverse it. If she says that to me, then I have to defend myself. Well, why didn't I make that phone call? Well, there's something wrong with me. Now, I'm instantly feeling emotionally assaulted. Now I have to defend myself. I'm back in my class, in third grade. I'm back with my punishing father. I'm back with all the million times in my life that somebody has been criticizing me, and I feel bad. My body reacts.
And so let me just ask. So that why didn't you do that? That's the blame attack.
That is the blame attack. Now, again, it's not just saying, oh, dear, you didn't make the phone call, in a calm, ordinary tone of voice, which clearly communicates that I'm also upset that you didn't make the phone call, but it's not an attack. It's not a blame attack. When you're on the receiving end of a blame attack, inevitably your body reacts. Your blood pressure goes up, heartbeat goes up, your body can be flooded with adrenaline, and all of a sudden, you have to respond. Now you have a reactive response, and you have to deal with the reactive response. And it's usually not very pretty. Either there's flat-out justification, which can often, you know, be distorting reality. I was going to, but something happened, and I had a car accident, or you know, somebody called, and so there's that fumbling sort of desperate way to explain myself so you don't keep attacking me and telling me that I'm stupid. Or you attack back. Well, last week you didn't call. What do you think? You're perfect? That's a reactive response. Let's do the husband-wife thing. Now my wife now says, what do you mean I didn't call? Why are you telling me I didn't call? I did call. And now the reason for the initial problem, which was the phone call did not get made, has now become a blame cycle. I defend and attack, she defends and attacks, I defend and attack, and we're defending and attacking back and forth. It describes our political system too, by the way.
And you say that blame, it finds fault with another person, basically, through criticism and accusation. And so talk about this fault finding.
Well, let's back up a little bit here.
Okay.
Because in my discussions with people about this, and the tremendous amount of confusion I get about it, is where does it come from? And it all comes from anxiety. It's all about anxiety. So if I'm the one who's upset because the phone call didn't get made, I get worried that. But this is on a very profound level. It's not like I'm saying to myself consciously, well, I'm really worried about the phone call because if I could do that, I probably wouldn't attack. So, but I'm feeling anxiety about the phone call, and I'm also feeling anxiety on a deeper level about the competence of my partner. Parent-child, same thing. Boss-employee, same thing. In almost any relationship, there's the anxiety about what did not happen or what happened that was wrong. And we are so hooked into our reactive response, the fight-flight syndrome, and it gets triggered so instantly, so many times, and I see it in so many situations with couples, with anybody, that we get trapped in that. And we're just starting to feel anxiety. And rather than resolve the anxiety in a productive way, it gets turned into a another attack. You're hurting me. I have to hurt you back.
And that's the blame spiral?
That's the blame spiral, right.
And so it just goes on and on. It just gets uglier. It doesn't stop getting ugly unless somebody stops it.
Correct.
And I want to go into a little bit the sort of primal stuff on blame and how it's part of our fight or flight syndrome. And we react, we're being attacked socially, but we think our adrenal system thinks we're being attacked by a tiger.
Oh, sure. Well, because human beings are intimately connected to status, where we fit in our relationship. And if things are going well, I'm at the risk of being a little personal this morning, my wife and I had a little discussion about something. I didn't even have to go into the content, but I said something snappy. I did. And it was just a little bit, well, a little snappy thing. And she looked at me and kind of said something slightly snappy back, and sort of turned away. And we both have enough experience now. You know, we're mature people, and we're psychologically and emotionally mature too, I like to say. And I walked away from it and kind of felt my body calming down. Within a half a second, my body was already alarmed. And it was so slight. And this is a huge question. Why does our body, I mean, I can't actually answer that, but why does our body get involved so instantly when it's just a matter of, I mean, there's no threat, but my body just gets, tense. And,
well,
yeah?
I might have an answer because I write a lot in the book I'm writing now, which also has a swear word in the title, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. I write a lot about reputation. And back when we evolved 1.8 million years ago or so, it was so serious to get thrown out of your group because there
That's
were
right.
no Motel 6s or 7-Elevens. You'd be walking barefoot alone in the Sahara and soon be eaten by something or overcome by the environment. And so, you know, that really a reputational threat, and you write about reputational threat in the book, it was a really serious thing. And so we are very big on saving face, even just, you know, between ourselves and another person.
Which, and the only way out of it is through thinking, because my thinking has to be pulled into action here, and I have to be able to call myself and say, come on, this is silly. This is not a reason to react. And I'm blessed that my wife knows that too, so then she calms down and she doesn't continue and I don't continue. And we kind of have an agreement that, you know, 3 to 5 or 6 minutes later, she'll say something calmly about something else and I know that we've moved on. You know, there's no grudge bearing. And I was thinking consciously this morning how fortunate I am that she can do that.
It's very important.
And I thank
important.
Her for it every now and then when I remember. That there's no grudge bearing. And it was just a little stupid mistake of which she makes them and I make them. And then my body returns to normal and we get on with life rather than staying stuck.
You reminded me of something. You have this great advice in your book, Beyond Blame. I'm talking with Dr. Carl Lasko about this subject that is far too little covered, blame. And it's this advice to exit the scene when you're too agitated to
exactly.
think.
Mm-hmm.
And people, they frequently feel compelled to answer questions when they aren't ready. And I have ADD, and one of the best things I've learned is that when I'm really impatient and don't want to talk about something, just to tell someone and say, you know, it's not, I'm never going to talk about this, but it's just, it's not a good time for me. My brain
mm-hmm.
is not cooperating. There are hawks, they're flying in there and pecking at carrion or something. And so that really makes a big difference for those people who can't get out of, you know, the feelings, the bad feelings, the anxiety, the stress, that they remember to take that break, to just make an exit.
Uh-huh. Well, Amy, you said earlier something about reputation. Well, if your brain can shift into gear and say, my reputation is not being ruined right now. I am not being thrown out of the tribe. I am not going to be exiled. I don't have to take this seriously. This is not a life-threatening situation. And just sit there and breathe. And that is, of course, the way to get out of most things, is just sit there and breathe, and everybody appreciates it. You know, we always admire somebody who can stay calm when things are flying around. And that's a sign of emotional maturity. But blame, when you're being criticized, accused, punished, or humiliated, those are the four components of blame. So again, criticism, accusation, punishment, and humiliation. Now, criticism is not that you forgot to make a phone call. That's not a criticism. That's a statement of a fact. Criticism is, why didn't you make the darn phone call? That's criticism. Criticism means there's something fundamentally wrong with you. So when you are on the receiving end of any of those four behaviors, your reaction is very powerful. And the way out of it, of course, is to think your way out of it.
And take us through the others. Take us through, there's accusation. So give us
an example. Accusation is probably, it's just horrible. I mean, the accusation is that you are capable of doing something bad. You have done something bad. You are dishonest. An accusation is simply that. You are being accused of something wrong. And so to be on the end of being accused, you know, if you didn't make the phone call, you didn't make it because, as I said, criticism is because you're stupid. But it could also be that you don't care, or you have another agenda going on, or you're selfish, and that's all you think about is yourself. And so you wouldn't make the phone call because you're so self-absorbed. So that's an accusation. How do you defend yourself? I'm not selfish. yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. And then punishment is when blame takes on a really, really powerful form of, which would be, you didn't make the phone call. Turn around, walk away, and refuse to engage, refuse to talk. I'm punishing you. I will show you that because you didn't fulfill this small little task, which I can't even ask you to make a phone call, can I? So therefore, I'm ignoring you.
So that's like physical abandonment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, punishment is a component of blame, and we don't think that it is, but it is.
And then
and
you
the final one is humiliation.
And you say that's the worst.
Humiliation is the worst because in the research, when people kill themselves because of an emotional situation, if humiliation is strong enough, it basically says, I don't have a right to live. You know, I am so bad, I'm so wrong that I don't, or, you know, bankruptcy for men sometimes, or tremendous failure. Depression is very different, but when blame is involved, and for children, for instance, or a teenager, when a teenager is humiliated because they make a mistake or they do something with their class, or they're wearing the wrong pair of shoes, they're humiliated for that. It's extremely painful. It goes very, very deep.
And you say, I want to get into why blame is so misunderstood, and you say, we assume it assigns responsibility and solves problems, you know, and therefore it's necessary, but you say that's wrong.
It's wrong because it's so incredibly disrespectful. When I get into the point of the whole section about positive accountability, I talk about, you know, how to get somebody to change behavior, you know, without making them feel bad about it. So, honey, you forgot to make a phone call today, and it really created a problem, and I'd like to work out some way so this doesn't happen again. Now, the tone of voice has to be very calm and not inflected with blame, right?
Yeah.
But we think that if I don't inflect my voice, if I don't let you know how incredibly angry I am or how little I think of you, you won't change. Fundamentally, that's incredibly disrespectful.
You say blame actually diverts us from solutions.
Correct.
Through creating all this animosity and divisiveness.
Correct. Yes, it does. When your body has taken over and now you're in a reactive mode, I mean, if you think back to or just review current history where, you know, there's wars going on, cold wars, hot wars, whichever they are, there's no problem solving going on. They're not saying, you know, we really do have to solve it. Where everybody is they're all wrapped up in their emotions. And their emotions are running the show. And negotiators, really, really, really competent negotiators, don't get emotional. They just keep staying on track. And, you know, situations can be resolved. Northern Ireland, for instance, if you want to take something that's extremely painful for a lot of people. But that takes calmness and focusing away from the reactive response, you know, your body's physical reaction.
And now you say that actually this criticism and accusation, instead of doing what people think it will do, criticizing and accusing someone to get them to change, uh-huh. that the criticism and accusation shift the focus onto the explosion that follows the blaming and away from the behavior that actually needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. And this is the worst in intense emotional relationships, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, any emotional relationship, dating, any committed relationship, people living together, where there's a lot at stake. You know, I'm giving you my heart, and you better take care of it. And if you don't, I'm going to make you pay.
That's very loving.
Well, yeah, that's not loving at all, unfortunately. And
yes, like you said, it comes from anxiety.
It does come from anxiety, exactly. It's difficult to strip it down to that. You know, it's extremely difficult. You know, I want what I want from you, and you're not giving it to me. And I'm feeling anxious, and I'm not feeling loved. And when am I ever going to feel loved? And how come I can't get love from you? So,
I have to say, one thing that you do in your book very well is that you really tear apart all these things that we don't really think about and define, even accountability, which we all think we know about. Holding somebody accountable sounds like such a good thing. We'll get to that later. I want to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest tonight is psychotherapist Carl Alasco, PhD. He's talking about blame, which is very toxic to relationships and many human interactions. And we're going to talk about how to stop blaming and take healthier, more productive steps to problem solving. Dr. Alasco's book is Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit. I love books with swear words in the title. Okay, so I wanted to get to, I love this passive-aggressive stuff. You say that blame hides behind the shield of good intentions. I'm only trying to point something out to you, only trying to help. That's what people say when they blame somebody for something.
Yes, I have a friend, and I had to confront her the other day about something because she just would continue to say, hey, I'm just putting it out there. I'm just putting it out there, as though that has no value to it. It's entirely neutral. No, it's not neutral at all, because what she's putting out there was controversial, and not, you know, and somewhat critical. But she would always go back to this thing of saying, "Well, I'm not doing anything. I'm just putting it out there," as though, again, you know. She herself can't be held accountable for anything because she's not doing anything but putting it out there. A circular kind of reasoning.
Right, right. And now we're going to get to, you know, how to convert blaming statements into positive accountability. But I love this thing that you write, and I'm, again, talking to Dr. Carl Lasko, author of Beyond Blame. You say that a test of whether something is a blame statement is whether it provokes a reaction of anger, resentment, anxiety, pain, fear, or humiliation.
Exactly.
And so if you feel any of these, or if your statement could likely provoke that in another person, that's blame.
Right. Now, I do have a caveat in there, which is, obviously, nobody can take an extreme example, extreme position on anything. For instance, I mean, nobody can take the position in a relationship where you say, no, you're blaming me. Wait a minute, I didn't say anything yet. Oh, I can tell. You're going to blame me. And that would be an extreme, right?
Yeah, and you say, I think you call this is in the little section, anyone can sabotage anything. And so
exactly.
People will do that stuff, you know, and if you're with somebody like that, that's a nasty person to be with. And it's very hard to solve problems with somebody who behaves that way.
Correct. Yes. So going back to the idea of how to hold somebody accountable.
Yes.
It's really two parts. One is, this is what happened. Or this is what you did. You forgot to make a phone call. And this is what I want to see happen. Or this is how I want to solve the problem. And that's it.
Okay.
Now,
and so do you say you're upset that they didn't make the phone call?
You certainly can. Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
I'm a little upset that you forgot to call and now we don't have a house to live in. I mean, this isn't me. But,
sure.
And I'd like that to change in the future.
Exactly. Right.
Okay. Instead of, as you say,
obviously, well, it depends on severity. you forgot to make the mortgage payment and now we're being foreclosed. Well, it depends on severity. But let's just say you forgot to make the phone call and Jill came over to the party because you forgot to tell her it was canceled.
That
was very embarrassing for me.
Yes. Okay.
All right? And that could be very common, right?
Right.
So that's a statement. Now, if I'm the person who forgot to make the phone call, now it's my turn to say, oh, yes, I did forget to make the call, and gosh, wow, I need to apologize to Jill, and I need to apologize to you.
Okay? So let me just look at what you're doing, because I really get this. It's that it's a statement of fact rather than what you said before, so damaging. Why don't you make the phone call, which is an accusation instead?
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
makes you feel, I can feel that, just those two statements, the difference. And you have this great quote in your book, The Why Statement. Why didn't you put the orange juice away? Answer, because I'm too stupid to remember. Do you feel better now that you know I'm brainless? So you can see the difference there.
Well, so if we're going back to the accountability issue, the question then remains, but if I just... If my wife didn't make the phone call and all I did was say to her, oh, you didn't make the phone call, and that was very embarrassing, and now Jill came to the party, and I'm embarrassed about that. Behind that is the anxiety of, if I don't really pound on this, you're never going to change. And again, that's highly disrespectful, as though we don't learn or we can't learn. Now, what happens in these discussions is somebody will say, I've tried that. I've tried it over and over and over, and my partner refuses to pay the bills or refuses to clean up or refuses to do this, refuses to do that. Well, and to which I say, okay, you have a chronic situation, you have a chronic problem, and blaming will only make it worse. Well, what am I supposed to do? Well, you have to now then go into another kind of problem solving, which is your chronic behavior is so serious that it threatens our relationship. Or your refusal to call me back when I leave you messages it threatens the validity of our friendship because I feel that I'm maintaining the friendship and you're not. Whew. So that's a confrontation. Now what are you going to do? But it all has to be without the reactive response. It can't be yelling, and it can't be accusatory, and can't be critical.
I love something that you say about this, what we're starting to talk about, the positive accountability, and we'll backtrack and talk about what that is specifically. But you say the goal of this kind of talking, positive accountability, is to lower everyone's emotional temperature.
Correct.
So just even the way you're discussing these sort of, you know, made-up statements, it's a cooler way of talking because there isn't that emotional stabbing that's going on of, you suck, no, you suck. You know, that sort of horrible thing that goes on and it just escalates into what you call a blame spiral.
Well, yes. Now, Amy, what people avoid and what they want to avoid is the reality that maybe they have to change their own behaviors and say, I have a chronic problem. How am I going to solve it without criticism, without getting into an argument and fight about it? Now, that puts the responsibility on me to say, I'm in relationship with somebody who has a chronic behavior that is damaging the relationship. So now I have to state that and calmly state it and say, if this behavior continues, I will have to take action of some other kind because you refuse to change. What kind of action is that going to be?
In those situations, I actually think it's very positive to do what you've just said to say that, but also to give yourself a deadline because that way you don't get in a situation where it goes on endlessly if they don't do something.
Right. You know, if you're in the kind of relationship where the person is given an ultimatum about something, and it doesn't have to be I'm going to divorce you, I'm going to leave, I'm going to. It could be, let's just take a domestic thing about cooking. You know, we have a chronic situation. I cook for you, and you refuse to clean up. So I get angry with you because you refuse to help me clean up. So I can just keep on getting angry and keep on cooking and keeping getting angry and keep on cooking and keeping getting angry. Or I can change my behavior and stop cooking.
Right. Yeah.
And, how come we don't have any dinner? Well, because I've been telling you for the last 3 months that I'm tired of being exploited. You take advantage of me. Oh, well, honey, I'm just tired when I come home. Oh, yes, you're tired and I'm not. So I'm not going to, I refuse to cook and to keep cleaning up also. So therefore, I'm going to change my behavior. No, but I want you to cook. Okay, good. So you're willing to clean up. I'll try.
I love that. I love that. But
sorry, it's not going to work. So putting the responsibility of changing on yourself, saying, well, wait a minute, I'm in a chronic situation. It's not getting any better. Yelling and shouting and fighting isn't getting me anywhere. So, but I'm holding this person accountable through positive accountability, which means if you don't want to change, I'll change.
And actually, I just I sort of guessed because you said, see, it's so hard with these terms. You use the term holding somebody accountable. And you said, you know, in your section on positive accountability, that is holding somebody accountable can often be a criticism and that we have to be accountable in voluntary ways.
Yes. In fact, I really prefer never to use that word holding somebody accountable at all.
That's why I was laughing.
Because you can't really hold anybody. I mean, you can accuse them or you can criticize them, you can punish them. Or you can say, through positive accountability, this is what's going on. I am cooking. You are not helping. So I am going to change my behavior, and I'm going to stop cooking. Well, how are you going to eat? Well, I'm going to make myself a sandwich all by myself. Which means, of course, though, the relationship is not improving, is it? I'm not feeling closer to you. I'm not feeling like you're collaborating with us together. So the relationship is now heading downhill. And yet, but I'm not fighting anymore about it.
And the person can either behave in a more loving and sharing way, or that's the point at which if they don't change at all, that maybe you decide, okay, I'm going to give this 2 months and then I am gone.
And that means assigning yourself that responsibility for changing rather than staying stuck in a blame spiral. Oh, we got into another fight. What did you get in a fight about? Oh, I cooked dinner again, and he refused to help me clean up again. Okay, so you're not managing to communicate, so what else can you do?
And
now, and then we need to also talk about the law of personal limitations, which is at the end of the book.
I want to just make sure that we define positive accountability. You say it involves two behaviors, to thoughtfully acknowledge an error, whether your own or another person's, and then consider how to repair it, and then to express an emotion or need that you have without using criticism or accusation or punishment or humiliation. You know, you're trying to not trigger these negative emotions, but you're expressing how you feel. I feel really crappy that you never clean up, and seems like you're taking for granted my cooking.
Exactly. Said very calmly and factually, and leaving out the emotional components which trigger a blame spiral, because we know that that absolutely doesn't work.
So no accusation, none of that. You say the worst is the why. Why don't you ever clean up? Then that, it sets up, you can see from what the way you've been talking, that sets up a totally different and very awful situation. And I should actually do a little station ID. This is Amy Elkhorn's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest tonight is psychotherapist Dr. Carl Lasko. He's talking about blame. He wrote Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit, and that is what we're talking about tonight. So you were talking about the law of personal limitations. What is that?
Well, in the book, I kind of use the college education system of saying, you know, the first part one of the book is you're working on your bachelor's in blame. Part two of the book is positive accountability. Now you're getting your master's degree. If you really want to continue on, Amy, it is very difficult. I'm challenged with this every day, or at least every week, recognizing that I'm up against my own personal limitations, and the law of personal limitations states that everyone is always doing as well as they can, considering their personal history, what they know and don't know, and the emotions they're feeling at the time. Now, that's just a fact. But people don't like to hear it because it makes it sound as though you're considering that you're giving the person a free ride. You're allowing them to do anything they want to do without consequences, to which I say that's not true at all. There's plenty of consequences going on for that person's behavior. What you have to do, though, is not get involved in a blame spiral with this person. So let's go back to cooking and cleaning. So let's just say, so I'm doing the cooking, and I really want you to clean up. And you say, you know, I hate cleaning up dishes. Oh, really? Yeah, it just bothers me. It's something, of all the things in the world, I hate cleaning up. Oh, so that's the reason why you haven't been doing it, maybe. Yeah, because, you know, it just bothers me. It's just, and one can then say, so that's one of my personal limitations. It's not like I can't. It's just I have so much resistance that I really have a limitation around that. Whereas I love to cook, so it's easy for me to cook and harder for you to clean up. Okay, so now how can we work with your, you know, sort of emotional limitation around that? How can we work so we work together?
See? And it seems that when you don't go into the blaming and criticizing them and you instead have that kind of conversation, you make room for empathy so you can understand, you know, a lot of people think, well, that's lazy, you know, that you can't just wash the dishes.
Uh-huh.
But people have things that bug them and, you know, you could maybe serve dinner on paper plates if that doesn't bother you. You know, there are ways, or at least you cannot feel, then I think you might not feel ripped off by the person.
Exactly. Now, when we're talking about your personal limitations, there's things that come naturally to each of us. You know, balancing the checkbook for some of us is a whiz, and for others it's just impossible. So you have to find a way to work around your limitation. It doesn't mean you never pay bills. It doesn't mean you bounce checks, but you have to find a way to work around it. What I have found as a psychotherapist is that confronting your own limitation allows you to get a better hold of it. You know, that's the whole thing about AA, for instance. You know, I admit it, I was powerless over alcohol, over whatever addiction it is. It's once you admit it, it's paradoxical. Then you have a better chance of grasping it, of working through it.
Right. It's so important. I think this is a very, very important bit in your book, and I'm talking with Dr. Carl Alasco about his book, Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit, and this thing of knowing your limitations. For example, in my case, I've talked about this before, I have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes for me, or thinking is like being attacked by a flock of crows. You know, or trying to write, it's like, you know, it's so hard. There's squirrels running different directions in my brain.
You have a lot of animals in your life.
Right. It's a very the woodland type of thing going on.
Very charming.
One of the things for me, realizing that I have problems with organization, I hire somebody part-time. She helps me organize things. We're going to go through my book chapter that I'm writing now, and she's going to help me critique. I've organized it, but I'm sure I've done a not the greatest job, and she'll critique that. So I have someone to help me, and knowing that I need help allowed me to hire someone to help me.
Wonderful. That's a perfect example. And then you don't go shaming yourself, criticizing yourself for, oh, I'm just worthless. Oh, I'll never get this done. I just can't. So you avoid self-criticism.
But getting to that point, you write about this. This is one of the most important things I learned from Dr. Albert Ellis, who co-founded cognitive behavioral therapy, and
right.
It's the notion that people are fallible and that I'm fallible. And I realize to be human is to be a muck-up. I was going to use the other swear word, but I've used a few today. So, and you say that, you know, our mistaken beliefs about perfection create self-blame. Instead of this thing where you say, like, oh, my God, here are all my limitations. Why don't I deal with them?
Correct. It's very liberating. Now, again, the counter-argument is, oh, so everybody just gets a free pass. Not at all. Not at all. And inevitably, you are accountable for your behaviors. I mean, it does happen. You do have to pay for them in one way or another. What I'm trying to eliminate, though, is in the process, there's a lot of criticism and accusation that just makes everybody upset. So it's an absolutely miraculous process when it's happened. It just de-escalates tension, and everybody feels better. And then, and this is important, when you do encounter a person who really, really has limitations that absolutely don't work for you, then you have to change the relationship. Whether it's an employee, whether it's a friend, whether it's a sibling, sometimes even a parent. And rather than continually try to blame this person for their inability to perform or fulfill some of an important need in your life, then you just say, you know what? It just doesn't work with Margaret. You know, I've tried with Margaret, and she just refuses, and I just have to sever the relationship. And then you move on.
But you move on
with compassion rather than anger.
And much less, none of that escalation that gets to the point where everyone's just angry and nobody hears or can think rationally.
Correct.
And I wanted to just add about this, the law of personal limitations, which is what you – right, it's that everybody's doing as well as they can within their personal limitations, their history, what they know, what they don't know, and if they could make a healthier decision, they would. And I'm sort of quoting from Beyond Blame by Dr. Carl Alasco, who I'm talking with right now. I see that as basically accepting reality. Not that you accept it and you resign yourself to it because maybe you don't want to be with the person anymore, but I find that really helpful in not being as mad at people who behave like jerks because they're jerks. So it's not realistic to expect people who are basically jerks to behave in another way.
Well, you started out the program with admitting that sort of yelling at the woman who was on her cell phone, et cetera. Afterward, you recognize that whatever was going on in her life, her limitation at that time was that she wasn't aware. And then when you made her aware, her emotional limitations were not such that she said, oh, gee, I'm sorry. No, she came about and attacked you.
Right. Well, it's very hard the way I approached her because I usually know better. And what I usually do is say, you know, I know it's a public street and you probably didn't think about this, but our houses are all really close to the property line. They're old and they're termite eaten. And so we can hear everything from your cars. And people are, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. So if I had just not been so annoyed and come out and just vaulted into, you're an ill-raised boor, basically, by saying to her, I can hear everything inside my house. She might have actually said, oh, my God, I didn't really think about how close I am. Instead,
correct.
I just made her want to come, you know, shoot me or clobber me or something.
Yes. One other example about the law of personal limitations. I was driving with a friend, pulled up to a stoplight, and there was a homeless person. However, it was probably 26 or 27 years old and looked completely healthy. And I had a dollar in my little glove compartment thing there, and I pulled it out, and I honked, and I handed it to the guy. And the person in the face says, why are you giving that money to him? I mean, he can get a job. And I said, you know, this is my sort of social conscience going on here. Standing there begging for money is his job. And if you think that that's easy standing there, the humiliation of asking for money on the side of a street, if that isn't a terrible, terrible place for this guy to be, if you think he's happy being there and he thinks, oh, God, I've scammed another sucker for a dollar, well, then you're not looking at his personal limitations at all. And I kind of gave this guy, this friend of mine, a bit of a lecture on it, and I don't know how far I got with it. But you see what the point? This young man had a huge amount of limitations in his life. Who am I to judge what they are? But the point is, he was asking for money. So he got a buck. He's not going to get rich. Right?
You broke up for a second, so repeat what you just said the last little bit.
Oh, I said the guy was standing on the corner. He got his dollar, but he's not going to get rich from it.
No, and that's a horrible way to live.
Yeah.
I have a friend who was homeless that I helped, and you know, it just said he has a roof over his head is such a huge thing. And my friend, he's just a guy. He's really hardworking, but he just doesn't have it together in how to deal with life.
Uh-huh.
And he's living with somebody now, and everything's okay. He's working very, very hard. But you know, I understand that, and I didn't think, well, screw you. You know, I could see that I was able to look at that stuff. So, but enough about me. I wanted to find out something very important. You say when we're confronted with the blame trap, you know, someone's saying, well, why didn't you do this? You say, don't take the bait. But tell us how we avoid taking the bait.
Probably the solution goes back a long, long, long time. Count to 10. I know that when I'm sitting with a couple, for instance, and they're throwing accusations back and forth, and it's really tight, I will very loudly, very audibly go, and do that one or two times. And sometimes it gets their attention, and sometimes they don't notice. But I do that to myself, not take the bait, not get caught up, not try to get in between them in some ineffective way. And so I must stay very calm. And that eventually will work. And I'll slow down my voice and say, may I say something to you now that I really want you to hear? That works. So the idea is when you're being agitated and there's the possibility of you, quote, taking the bait, that's when you have to go the opposite direction and slow it way down so that you can allow your body to go back to sort of its normal place rather than getting agitated.
I like your idea, too, of making an exit, you know, if you have to leave the room. But that could also be that abandonment thing. And I thought, too, that if couples start to, they realize they're getting into the blame spiral, they could do what people do in S&M and have a safe word, you know, that they agree on a word like pineapple. You know, you say, if it's starting to get ugly, one person calls pineapple and they have to freeze like Twister.
Exactly. And that has to be the agreement. And then, again, if you say... if the ultimate ridiculous situation is, oh, we can never agree to anything like that, well, then what kind of relationship do you have? Then you have to question that you're really committed to staying inside the blame spiral, and that's where you want to live. So then stay there.
It's like being perpetually eight.
Yeah, yes.
And now I wanted to ask you, because some people have such problems at their office, you talk about the workplace and using positive accountability to deal with problems there. Like, for example, how would you use that to deal with, say, exploitation by your boss?
Well, I give several examples, and they all come back to, but they're basically one example. And the primary example is to be extremely strategic, which means to be very, very thoughtful. Which, again, in real life, that means to go home, think very carefully about what happened, talk to somebody who you trust to get advice, talk to two people, three people. This is what's going on at work. What do you suggest? And here's all the history, all the information. How should I handle this? Again, this is the other side of the spectrum from reactivity. It's either, you can't treat me that way, I'm quitting, which is, you know, really stupid. The examples I give in the book, really, when strategy means a thoughtful decision about how to proceed. And that's what, you know, in military strategy, it's extremely thoughtful, what's the best way to proceed? Which way are we going to do this? And you do have options, and sometimes they're very good options. But if there's reactivity going on, then you no longer have options.
And so you approach them basically the same way you approach your partner, which is without blaming, with here's the problem, with that slow and reasoned approach.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can solve it, maybe you have to leave.
Yes. And if you do have to leave, but you want to make sure absolutely that was the only thing you could do. That it wasn't, I mean, how many times, even the worst possible violation in a relationship, like an affair, it doesn't necessarily mean the marriage is over or the relationship's over. It does mean the marriage or relationship is very much in crisis. And I've watched couples absolutely tear themselves apart and I've watched other couples where one party is very thoughtful about the whole thing, lets it all work out, comes around, and then finally, very carefully and very strategically, they get back together again. Often, the person who has committed the infraction is extremely grateful for the offended partner's thoughtful, strategic thinking. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I you know, I've read a lot about this. There are people, because the common thing is, oh, ditch that, whatever.
Yeah. Exactly.
Really,
make him pay.
Right, or her. I mean, it's very immature thinking, and if your relationship is just about, you know, I understand people are upset about betrayal and everything, but is there more to your relationship than just like they had sex with somebody else? Can't you talk about it? It's always sort of amazing to me that people do that.
Mm-hmm.
And now I wanted to also talk about, you talk about this in parenting. So what's thoughtful parental power?
I think that's one of the most important issues of the whole book is the I certainly see it a lot more today. I mean, you know, we all see parents are doing such a much better job. I mean, you see dads carrying their babies around, you know, and it's getting more equitable. You see more dads. I mean, the whole gender equality thing is working itself out really, really well in parenting. But still, there's violations. But the idea is the parents have so much power. So to criticize your child, and which means to imply, well, well, how come you didn't get your, you didn't get all the words right in your test? How come didn't you study? I told you this, implying that your child is somehow defective, lazy, not motivated, and children are, you know, lazy and not motivated many times. But, and that's a situational thing. Sometimes it's part of their personal limitations. But the core idea is to always, always, always focus strategically on maintaining the relationship. And there's beautiful moments when the parent says, honey, come over here and talk to me about what happened in school today. Could you just sort of tell me what happened with the teacher? Wow. You know, you might get some information. And you're building the relationship, and you're giving the child a chance to, I mean, you're using your power very, very, very strategically, very thoughtfully.
I love this bit you have in that chapter. You say, above all, stay calm, never raise your voice. In fact, talk more slowly and quietly than usual, and even walk more slowly. That will get her attention. She'll probably think you've been taken over by vampires, which might be kind of cool. And actually, I mean, I see this. My neighbor is just such a great mother, and she did something amazing with her son. She was very disappointed. He had let his math grades slip. And instead of doing blaming, instead of saying, how could you let your math grade slip, she said, you know, I just want to let you know how important it is, how much it means to me that you do well in school. Uh-huh. And, you know, and she just gave him a little positive talk like that, and he yanked up his grades, and he's much more diligent now. And it's so amazing how just this little thing of, like, I'm so proud when you do well, and I like when you do well, and it means a lot to me. But that was so motivating.
Yes, I agree. Well, the sort of to conclude the whole focus of the book, the it's the relationship that's important always, whatever relationship it is, and when blame is not used, when criticism, accusation, punishment, and humiliation are not used in the communication process, the relationship flourishes. And then each person's intrinsic desire to please the other, and that has to be there, right? You know, if you're in a friendship with somebody, you have an intrinsic desire to please this person. Otherwise, it's not a friendship. It's something else, right?
Right.
So that the child has an intrinsic desire to please the parent, and your sweetheart has it back and forth. You know, we all have that. But if it's missing, if it's not there, then you have to take other steps. But to fight and argue because it's not there, you're not trying to please me. You know, I'm cooking and you're not cleaning up. You don't have any desire to please me. Then we have to examine it, don't we?
Now, we are almost out of time, but this brings me to this thing I love that you talk about in your book, and I should say who I'm talking with. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. I'm talking with Dr. Carl Alasco, PhD, about his book Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit, and this, of course, is Amy Alcon, the Advice Goddess. You have this great bit about the question of intention, about positive accountability versus blaming, and you say that you need to ask yourself in that moment where you're about to blame somebody, what do I want to accomplish right now? What's my goal? What kind of relationship do I want?
That is the golden rule of relationships, really. If that could be installed, and I know in all of my interactions, when I forget that, I'm in trouble because my... You know, I didn't grow up with very good teaching, so I grew up learning to be reactive. And without thinking about my intention, I'll naturally, my default position is to react. And that never works. It's always bad.
I know. Mine too. You know, I'm a hothead. I have red hair. And the first thing I want to do when somebody gets on a cell phone, the No Cell Phones Cafe, I really wish, I'm actually just hostile, not violent, but I wish I had a Nerf bat. I want to go over and clobber them. But that is so ineffective. And so what I do instead is I get down so I won't be all, you know, I'm tall, so I won't be all aggressive. And I say, oh, excuse me, they have a no cell phones policy here. They like that you take your calls outside. I couldn't be nicer if I sprinkled them with fairy dust. No accusation. No, you're a jerk. You're rude, which you are. But, I mean, not you, but the person on the phone shouting, you know, in the where everybody's sitting there quietly. But it's the effective thing, and that's the thing I realized from reading that, what you said, the question of intention, what do I want to accomplish right now?
Right.
If I approach them with a hit them with a Nerf bat thing, that's not going to end well.
Exactly. And what you're doing is you're communicating the factual situation without criticizing or accusing the other person.
Oh, my God, I learned something. It's so great. I love it. I sometimes behave effectively. I want to thank you. This has been such an amazing show. This is Amy Alcon. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life. I've been talking with Dr. Carl Lasko, PhD. His book is Beyond Blame, Freeing Yourself from the Most Toxic Form of Emotional Bullshit. Carl,
and it's
thank
published
you.
By Tarcher Penguin. Nationally distributed.
Oh, yes. They can find it on Amazon and in bookstores, and I hope that people buy it because we all need to stop blaming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you promise to love each other for richer and poorer?
I do.
I do.
I now pronounce... Wait. If you'd like things to be more richer than poorer, you should open an account at Westcom. It's a member-owned, not-for-profit financial co-op that gives you low rates on loans and credit cards and great savings yields. You hear what I'm saying?
I do.
I do, too.
Westcom. The best bank for you may not be a bank at all. Westcom.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Certain terms may apply.
What was the original crowdfunding project? It's not the people who raised money for the zombie movie. Or the indoor beehive. Crowdfunding started with credit unions, like Westcom. We're a member-owned financial co-op. Our members are putting their money together to offer each other low credit card and loan rates and high yields on savings accounts. Fund your future at Westcom.
Westcom. The best bank for you may not be a bank at all. Westcom.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Certain terms may apply.